a lot of anger and stress and anxiety. In the U.S. in particular, anxiety disorders, mental illness, depression, and of course addictions of all sorts are reaching epidemic proportions. So what we're doing in this weekend is extremely timely. What's particularly a sad commentary in our society is that the suicide rates in our country has risen 24% in the last 15 years, according to the National Center of Health. One writer quipped, "It seems that young people are killing themselves at alarming rates because they feel like they have nothing to live for. And older people are often ending their life prematurely because they feel like they have lived for nothing." How sad that is, that so many people seem to lack purpose. And the result of a sense of meaninglessness ultimately is despair that leads to sort of a hopelessness, which is becoming ubiquitous in our culture. And so, I ask you this morning, is it well with your soul? Or in moments of introspection, do you find that there's a gaping hole in it? It was Augustine who said in the 4th century that every person has within them an eternal restlessness which will never be quieted until they find their peace with God. In my research for this series of lessons on addiction, it's been quite enlightening. I did some reading about a Dr. Kareem, who is a well-known addiction therapist, and he says that the real root cause of addiction is a lack of completeness or a lack of wholeness. And so he says the key in his judgment, and I agree with this, is to find the real reason you're addicted by first finding what is missing. He says, find the reason you continue to seek out behaviors of self-destruction and acknowledge what it is. Instead of admitting defeat and determining you'll just live a life full of addiction, consider the possibility addiction is misunderstood and unnecessary, and consider addiction to be a symptom of incompleteness and wholeness to be the solution. So the question is, how does one get whole as a human being? And if you're not there, how do you cure the hole in the soul? This lesson is more philosophical in nature. It deals with, you know, what is life really all about? In too many cases today, people are buying into Satan's deceptions and looking for wholeness, looking for meaning, looking for love in all the wrong places. Modern man is like a child in a dark room, frantically looking for the light switch, and in the process feels frightened and alone. Desperate for meaning in life, sadly, more and more people are substituting the world standards for God's. And in search for the good life, they reject the best life. And the drug culture in today's world is often where people are substituting some temporary high or experience for meaningful purpose. And so it's self-absorbing for the moment, but ultimately leaves people empty, only living for the next moment of escape. And the result is a sense of despair that often does severe damage to the soul if not addressed in time. So, what I want to look at today is, I just call this Wisdom for the Soul, Lessons from Solomon. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 29, God hath made man upright, but man has sought out many inventions, many substitutes for the things that ultimately will give us meaning and purpose, and as Jesus said, joy that ultimately is full. And so we're going to look today at a couple of key thoughts. First of all, we're going to look at three paths that Solomon points out in the book of Ecclesiastes that clearly are not the right path. The world says this is the American dream, this is what you need to pursue with gusto. Solomon says, been there, done that, that doesn't work. And then secondly, we're going to look at the fourth path, which is his conclusion and the answer to the meaning of life. So let's look at wrong path number one. Wrong path number one. I'll just call this, for lack of a better term, intellectualism. This is the idea that I can just sort of figure this out based on my own observation and my own intellect, and I don't need God or any kind of spiritual revelation. I can figure out on my own the answers to the questions of who am I and why am I here and what's it all about. One of the problems, I think, with our day is what C.S. Lewis referred to as chronological snobbery. And that is the idea that somehow or other, the latest is always the greatest. And everybody wants to be on the cutting edge of technology. Now, if you're talking about the latest and greatest iPhone, you may be correct if you're talking about some sort of technological advancement. But that absolutely has no connection with somebody trying to determine their moral compass. Some new invention has nothing to do with deep spiritual issues and matters of the soul. And sometimes I believe we just so much in our culture worship science and technology that we have forgotten that. Science and technology can only go so far in dealing with the things around us. In fact, the really profound questions that really matter really have nothing to do with some latter-day invention. I mean, why is it that a philosopher from antiquity can converse readily with a modern-day philosopher on all the basic questions that really plague mankind? Solomon put it this way in Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 9. He says, that which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So ultimately, he says, there is nothing new under the sun. Obviously, that's not to say that there's not new discoveries and new inventions and sometimes even new cures for bodily ailments. But this does say, when it comes to the fundamental aspects of life, really nothing new. You can call it the new age, but there's no new cures for the soul. And the good news is that we can learn from other people and we can learn from God's revelation about what our life is all about. We don't have to go about experimenting and figuring this out all on our own in a vacuum. We don't have to spend our life chasing down the pots at the end of every rainbow, frantically trying to answer ultimate life's questions. Beloved, it's already been revealed to us. In fact, one of the most profound passages I just love is Solomon saying in Proverbs 4, verses 25 and following. He says, let your eyes look directly ahead, and let your gaze be fixed in front of you. Watch the path of your feet, and all your ways will be established. Do not turn to the right nor to the left. Turn your foot from evil. What a blessing it is to have all of these conflicting messages and all of these conflicting paths and all of these terrible role models all around us. And to, as believers in God and his revelation, recognize those all lead down to nothing but blind alleys. That's not the way you want to spend your life. If you do that, you'll be wasting your life. but instead stick to the everlasting way, as David referred to it. Stick to the path of righteousness that God has outlined for us, and we can avoid so much heartache. Don't go to the left. Don't go to the right. You keep your eyes right on. And when we get to the end of this message, we're going to determine what that simple path is. And to those of you that are parents in the audience today, let me beg you to constantly be instructing your children about the dangers of choosing the wrong paths. And that the American dream that we all think is so important is often nothing but a deception that ends in a nightmare, especially when it comes to our soul. So, this wrong path of intellectualism is addressed for us by Solomon, who refers to himself as the preacher. And so Solomon says, you know, I looked around, and I, the preacher, I've been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore my wisdom concerning all that hath been done under heaven. He says, it's a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Remember, God gave Solomon more wisdom than any other man before him or after him. So this is a guy that we can listen to, right? Nobody, except perhaps Jesus himself, is wiser as a man than Solomon. So he says, I took this knowledge, this special intellect that God has given me as a gift, and I detached myself, and I kind of was looking at it almost as a third party and observing all of these things as I experimented with them. He says in Ecclesiastes 1:16-18, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were in Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I realized that this also is striving after the wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief. And increasing knowledge just results in increasing pain. So, what is the result of Solomon, apart from God, just trying to figure this all out with the world's most superior intellect? He says, I found out it's a grievous task, and I cannot find out. So, there's a real lesson in that for modern man. I mean, this man ought to know. And in this book, he basically goes down every road, turns every corner, turns every page. And he says, all of these paths that I followed as I was trying to find meaning, they're all vanity. It's another way of saying they're really no value. It's like trying to go out and catch the wind. We live in an age where the secular elitists think they're just so smart, and they really turn their nose up at faith or belief in God, or as was mentioned earlier, even the existence of our spirit or the spiritual realm. How can people be so educated yet so ignorant about what really matters? And they are supposed to instruct us about how to cure the hole in the soul. I'm so glad that we don't have to go out and experiment on our own to figure all this out. Solomon's already done all of that and given us the answer. And I don't care how many PhDs a man or woman has today, human wisdom or modern ideas are not the answers to the real profound questions of life. They don't deal with the sin-sick soul. They basically have taken God out of the schools, and most of the way that God and spirituality is presented in the media is making it a joke. How's that working for us as a culture? You know, you go to the Genesis account, and we find that the world was created for our bodies to dwell and live, and our bodies were created for our souls to dwell. And our souls, the eternal part of us, was created for God's glory. No amount of human philosophy or wisdom will change those facts. Solomon goes on to clarify that wisdom is good. It's certainly better than being ignorant. He says in Ecclesiastes 2, 13 and 14, "And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness." He says the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. He says, certainly, I can look around and see it's good to act as prudently and as wisely as we can. But that doesn't mean that it answers the ultimate, eternal, spiritual questions that really matter fundamentally. He says in Ecclesiastes 2, verse 14, "And yet I know the one fate befalls them both, both the wise and the fool. So I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. And then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. It is as much as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool die alike." So again, when you just look at life under the sun, S-U-N, apart from any spiritual dimension, Solomon realized that death is the great equalizer of everyone. That even if you are very successful in the short speck of time in which you live, and you acquire a lot of this world's goods, we're all going to die, it's going to be over soon, and none of those things of the world can we take with us. There's a fella at a funeral, and he heard the people in front of him talking, and the man that had died was extremely wealthy, and the fellow leaned over to his friend and said, "How much did he leave behind?" And his friend leaned over loud enough so that my friend could hear. He said, "All of it." You will never see a hearse carrying a U-Haul. We need to remember that. We leave all of it. Which leads me to the next wrong path, and that is materialism. Some people talk about retail therapy, like somehow or other life's answers is all found in acquiring material things and having the latest and the greatest. Materialism is a noun, and it means a tendency to think material objects are more important than people, and desire for money over ethics. I think as Americans, because of our consumerism and our materialistic society, it is hard to keep that in perspective, because we're just bombarded with this philosophy that says, I will get all I can all I get, and then sit on the can. As if that's somehow or other the answer to a meaningful life. And some people brag about it. I marvel at what bumper stickers often say about a culture. And one of the stupidest bumper stickers I've ever seen is the one that just simply says, "He who dies with the most ties, with the most ties, with the most toys wins." Whether it's ties or toys, what a stupid thing to say. Grab for all the gusto, because you only go around once. You know, in a certain context, I agree with that. I mean, carpe diem, seize the day, make the most of your life, which is precious. But if what you mean by that is I'm going to live for self and all that I can acquire, honestly, that's just a foolish statement. And akin to this problem of materialism is hedonism. And a hedonist, by definition, is someone who believes that the pursuit of pleasure is the most important thing to life. And Paul warns us that in the last days, perilous times will come. And there's a long list there. And one of them that is just fascinating to me is it says, men will become lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Does that describe our age or what? again, a bumper sticker that seems to personify this idea that everything is just about what pleasurable and feels good, is the bumper sticker that says, if it feels good, do it. Years ago, I was stopped at a stoplight, and the car in front of me had that bumper sticker on it. If it feels good, do it. And I was just sort of seething as I thought about, that is such a terrible philosophy of life. In fact, for a moment, just to prove a point, I almost wanted to ram the car in front of me. Then if the guy comes out and says, what are you doing? I could say, well, if it feels good, do it. And I think that's an awful philosophy, and I just want to show you what the ultimate fulfillment of that is. So welcome to your crash car. But of course, it would have crashed mine as well. Not a very Christ-like thing to do. I did not give in to that temptation. But I just want you to know that, again, these bumper stickers just say a lot about our culture. So if it feels good to have an affair and to violate your vows and to break up your family in the short run, just do it, right? Is that, the Bible says, he that commits adultery is void of understanding. But this is really nothing new. Paul's sermon on Mars Hill, he talks about the Stoics and the Epicureans. The Epicureans, he says in Acts 17, verse 18, had the philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. So it's all about just wringing every possible ounce of pleasure and joy out of your body that you can in the moment, because you never know when your life will end. And we live in a day, and I think this is particularly difficult for men in our culture, where we tend to think that our self-worth is equal our net worth. And if we're not really being super successful financially, then somehow or other, you know, we're not really worth much, at least not in America. I want you to think about this. If that's true, if our sense of worth is all attached to how much pleasure we're receiving, how much fun we're having, how much money we have, what does that say about Jesus? How much time does it appear in Jesus' 33 years that he spent acquiring this world's goods and seeking after just some sort of pleasurable experience? The Bible says, foxes have holes and the birds have nests, but the Son of Man hath nowhere to lay his head. Our purpose in life is to be conformed to the image of God's dear Son. It has absolutely nothing to do with these two pursuits, which become just almost the obsession of so many of our counterparts in the world. And I want to repeat again, Solomon had it all. He tried it all. And unlike us, he had the resources not to deny himself anything or any pleasure. In fact, he made the amazing statement that whatsoever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. Wow. One writer said that Solomon's wealth makes Donald Trump, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett all look like paupers. I mean, they didn't even talk about silverware in his day. It was goldware. And in a day when men had harems, he could have as many women as he wanted. I mean, he was the king. 700 wives and 300 concubines. My guess is he had a hard time keeping them straight. I know he had a hard time keeping them in line from some of the proverbs he wrote about those things. Never figure out how the wisest man that ever lived could choose to live with 1,000 women. But I will talk about that at some other time. But I digress. But I want you to realize that people today think, if I could just have this, or if I could just do that, well, you know, then I'd be happy. And these dreams we have elude us because we don't have unlimited resources. And so we think that, you know, if I just could just get out there, then somehow or other that would put everything together for me. Here's a man who had unlimited resources. Here's a man that none of those things eluded him. Whatever he wanted, he could just go out and get or buy or purchase. It was just insatiable. And the wealthiest man perhaps that ever lived says, I kept my intellect out here observing all of this, and I'm telling you, it is not what it is cracked up to be. That is not the ultimate meaning of life. Look at all these celebrities that our culture worships. And they reach the top of their fame, and they have good looks and money, and world famous, and oftentimes they go into some sort of drug situation or suicide because they get to the top and they look down and they go, wow, what do I do now? They're filled with despair because they've been focusing in on the wrong things as far as what gives life meaning. Notice what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 2, beginning of verse 4. He says, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself, which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. And I bought male and female servants, and I had homeborn servants. So I've been wealthy so long, my servants have been here long enough to have their children grow up now to be a part of my pool of servants. Also, I possess flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for my labor. I mean, most people would say, wow, this is the ultimate. Solomon says, I had the ultimate, and this is his conclusion in verse 11. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted and all the pleasure I enjoyed. And behold, I determined all of this was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit in it. My question is, do you believe that? That that's not really as important as what the world around us constantly is telling us it is? I hope so, because if you can really believe that, it's a part of being set free. Seneca said, no man is free who is a slave to his own lust. False pursuits do not lead to true joy. They ultimately lead to despair and to a drug culture. Why is this? Listen carefully. Material things do not fill the hole in the soul. Jesus said, man cannot live by bread alone. The idea is material things, but by everything that proceeds out of the word of God. Material things will perish, but the soul will live forever. And people have this huge hole in the soul, and they're trying to fill it with material things, and it just becomes an obsession, and it doesn't end anywhere. He goes on to say, the eye is not satisfied with the seeing, nor the ear with the hearing. It's just incessant. And I say addictive. I just need one more thing. I just need one more hookup. I just need one more trip. But if your soul is ultimately what's aching and what is starved, it's all meaningless. And we as Christians need to make sure that we don't live for things and worship the things money can buy. Remember, we don't worry today about bowing down to physical idols like Molech or Chemosh or Baal. But Paul says in Colossians 3 and verse 5, covetousness is idolatry. And this is all tricky because there's nothing inherently wrong with any of these things, but they must not become our primary pursuit. That's why Jesus warned, beware of every form of greed, for a man's life does not consist of the abundance of the things that he possesses. The real problem is, if all our hopes are in this life, like most people around us, then we fear death as the greatest tragedy, and our life becomes rather hollow. The Stoics would say, happiness comes not in having many things, but in learning to need few things. I think there's some truth in that. Let's learn to love people and use things, but never use people and love things. It's better to leave nothing one day and go to everything than to leave everything and go to nothing. Amen? Wrong path number three is what I'll just call existentialism. It is the psychology of meaninglessness, which is becoming increasingly popular in our culture. And the paintings of existentialists are just bizarre, because their idea is we're all just a part of random chance. We all just happen to be lucky enough to be at the top of the evolutionary food chain. So there's really no meaning to all of this. We're all just a bunch of accidents and random mutations. And so the only meaning in life is what you assign to it. And everybody comes up with their own formula. And so you can come up with anything you want. Thus these bizarre pictures of reality, which is just whatever you want to make it. Sad part of that is there's no dignity in life, and there's no eternity in our hearts. Very popular these days to be an agnostic. A lot of people say, okay, I have to recognize that such intricate design all around us demands a designer. So yeah, I believe in some superior being, but obviously whoever the superior being was, it's just like he wound up the universe like a clock, and now he's left it to unwind, and he's left us to our own devices. No hope, no purpose, no justice, and life is increasingly unfair. An existentialist really becomes someone who gives themselves over to cynicism. Elliot Richardson said, people have moved beyond apathy, beyond skepticism, into deep cynicism. And a part of it is, this is what happens when there's no spiritual dimension and no God in people's paradigm by which they view life. So Solomon talks a lot about this in Ecclesiastes 4. He says, and I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who were already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than most of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. Wow. So again, just looking at what's going on around you, and you see all these inequities and all this cruelty and all this poverty, and you see oftentimes wicked people prospering and righteous people suffering, he says, people that never even made it out of the womb, that were stillborn, are better off than those who did. I mean, that's the ultimate path of cynicism. That life is just one cruel hoax. So why not? If there's really no God and there's no afterlife and there's no meaning, why not just commit suicide, or why not just seek for some sort of pleasurable experience? Engage in reckless behavior, because what difference does it make anyway? Let me give you a quick overview. Intellectualism, human wisdom, and philosophy will leave you empty and morally bankrupt, chasing your own tail. Materialism and hedonism may provide some pleasure. The Bible talks about the pleasures of sin for a season. But it will never nourish the soul. In fact, it will destroy the soul. And existentialism, the essence of cynicism, says, I don't know anything but the fact that I am here. And these really supposedly brilliant philosophers, here's their most profound contribution. I think, therefore, I am. Who? Really? That's the best you can come up with? Listen, these things fill up the mind and soul with garbage and ultimately are self-defeating. And the only way to avoid these blind alleys is to trust the wisdom of the wisest man that ever lived and remember that he has been there and done that, and he has very clearly revealed for us what the solution is. What is the right path? The right path, I'll just call this path number four, That is, that God is, that he is able, that we must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. There's meaning and reward and value in serving God, who really cares about you and loves you as an individual and wants a relationship with you. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, 1 and 2. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God, for God is in heaven and you are on the earth. So Solomon says, listen, we need to recognize that we as man don't have all the answers. In fact, we are helpless before our Creator who does. And therefore, 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, we can cast all our anxieties upon him, knowing that he careth for us. And we can trust that everything will be made right in due time, and life does not have to be fair. Modern man just is filled with so much anger when they see all the inequities around them, and they just let it just eat them alive. Solomon says, do what you can to make a good contribution. But Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 8, he says, marvel not, but there is one that is higher than the high regardeth. Listen, there is a real Supreme Court in our universe, and it's not in Washington, D.C., with 9 men that are wearing robes that are all appointed by men who often make horrendous decisions. But we can trust in God, who ultimately is going to set everything right, so I don't have to be worried about vengeance. It doesn't belong to me. I can just trust in God and know ultimately everything is going to be such that God is working out even my difficulties out for my own good as long as I love him and are called according to his purpose. Wow. What a different perspective. Talk about the opposite of cynicism. To remember that ultimately God is working out for you even when you don't feel it. So have faith and be thankful. You know, we live in a society where more and more there's this spirit of entitlement. See, everything is about materialism, and people are angry that they're not getting what they think is their fair share of the pie. And so I'm going to go out and riot and just, you know, get involved in the political arena and force redistribution of wealth and all these different ideas that oftentimes are just fueled by a lack of contentment and anger and envy at other people and what they have. Do you know that a spirit of gratefulness, an attitude of gratitude, is the foundation of all virtues? And that I really, from my study, have come to the conclusion that gratefulness is really one of the keys to good mental health. And if a person learns to be content and thankful for what they have, they won't be looking for some high to try to help them escape from how terrible life is. No wonder folks that deal with all types of addictive behavior often talk about the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity, the contentment to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Are you aware that having a spiritual perspective gives life meaning in both sorrow and joy? I was amazed to hear of a family whose 8-year-old daughter died suddenly in a car wreck. Dedicated Christians, of course, overwhelmed with grief, as you might imagine. But instead of torturing themselves with the questions of why and why me and why her, without an ounce of bitterness, they said, we don't understand this, but this makes heaven mean even more to us because we know that we can spend eternity with her one day. Wow. And in sorrow, we can receive comfort from God, for he is an ever-present help in time of trouble. And if he disturbs your path, look for his purposes. And in joy, Solomon talked about this in Ecclesiastes 2, verse 24. He says, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and to tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? In other words, one of the things that does give meaning is the satisfaction of a job well done. And so, work hard. Enjoy the fruit of your labor. Remember that the desire accomplished is sweet for the soul. Proverbs 13, verse 19. Demonstrate among yourself an attitude of gratitude. Live honestly, honorably. Appreciate what God has given you. And you can have a good life. And I think it's fascinating how he summarizes the right path at the very end of the book. Very famous passage. He says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. See, this is all about filling the hole, right? What's the conclusion of the whole matter? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. I mean, you and I have a choice to make. We can either try to live for the little speck of time in which we have this short earthly dwelling, or we can look at the line that goes out into infinity and invest our time and our efforts, not in the dot, but in the line. We can't take the things that we acquire here with us, but we can take even a cup of cold water in the name of Jesus with us as we lay treasures in heaven up on the other side. And God's going to bring every work that we do into judgment, recognizing that us being kind and loving and service-oriented, those are treasures that we meet on the other side. And God says, well done. So what gives life meaning? It's the good we do in life. It's what we do with our souls to worship and glorify God, knowing that we're going to meet those things on the other side. No wonder Henry Ward Beecher said, happiness is not the end of life. That's what Americans think. He says, character is. And God is much more interested in our holiness and character than in our comfort or our momentary pleasure. So we're back to where we started. Let your eyes look directly ahead. Let your gaze be fixed right on in front of you. Watch the path of your feet, and all your ways will be established. Do not turn to the right or the left. Turn your foot from evil. Isn't it a blessing to have all of these wrong paths spelled out for us so we can avoid them? And then the right path laid out for us with all these blessings, so we can know how to live our life. This is the ultimate wisdom for the soul. You and I can spend our life any way we like it. But I recommend, because you can only spend it once, that you spend it for something that outlasts it. So I ask you, what is priority job one in your heart and in your life? Only God can give you meaning and fill up the hole in the soul. I recommend you fill it up with he who was able to fill all in all. And if you get off the throne and let Jesus take his rightful place, then you're in a position where you can be filled up with God's Spirit, and that means joy and love and peace, which is what everybody wants. And finally, you have contentment and a soul that is nourished. It's fascinating to me in Acts chapter 2, in verse 40, that in the very first gospel sermon, Peter says, save yourselves from this crooked, perverse, an untoward generation. Literally, the idea is save yourselves from aimlessness. Save yourselves from meaninglessness, which is what the pagan world was all about. When you obey the gospel, you're saving yourself from meaninglessness and from purposelessness. I like to tell people the purpose of life is a life of purpose. And only God provides that and the solution to the hole in the soul. The invitation song it's been selected, is where he leads, I will follow. Is that you? Do you need to make a decision to follow the Lord in some way today? Maybe you need to come forward and ask for prayers, just get your priorities right. Or maybe you've never made that decision to come out of meaninglessness and out of these wrong paths and follow the everlasting way and start that by repenting and being baptized this very hour. Anyone ready? Won't you come? As together we stand, we sing.